Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In this podcast, we're going to look at the development of modern linguistics, from its beginnings around 200 years ago up to the present day. Although our focus will be on academic linguistics, we won't simply be recounting the heroic exploits of the founding figures of the field. Rather, we'll endeavour to examine the emergence of ideas and practices and the controversies surrounding them in their social and cultural context. We begin in this episode by looking at the prehistory of comparative historical grammar, the first modern linguistic paradigm to be institutionalised as a university subject, with professors, textbooks, classes, and students. Comparative historical grammar is the field that tells us that languages are related to one another in a genealogical sense. For example, that French, Italian, Spanish, and many other languages are siblings descended from the common ancestor Latin. Such close-knit family relationships are fairly obvious and have long been acknowledged. But the great insight that made comparative historical grammar possible was to recognize much more distant relationships of this kind, specifically the similarities between classical languages of the East, such as Sanskrit and Persian, and classical languages of the West, such as Latin and ancient Greek, led European scholars to imagine a great Indo-European language family and to undertake the task of sketching its family tree. For almost as long as linguistics has existed as a discipline, it's had a standard history. In this standard history, this genealogical approach is generally considered the first truly scientific study of language. One of the earliest claims of this nature comes from the German scholar Theodor Benfey in his 1869 History of Linguistics. Describing the new impulses in language study in the first half of the 19th century, he said, "The turn that now occurred was so tremendous that hardly a stone was left standing from what came before, that previous works sank to being of purely historical value, that linguistics now began to become a science." As we'll see in coming episodes, such claims to a new scientific status that sweeps away all preceding scholarship are a recurrent motif in the history of linguistics and allied fields. We might even be able to say that such claims are one of the defining characteristics of the human sciences. Benfey's book is one of the earliest works to start canonizing the history of linguistics, and the first saint in this canon is the British Orientalist Sir William Jones. Benfey quotes a passage from Jones that's achieved the status of a ritual incantation recited at the opening of every disciplinary history. Let's participate in this ritual and quote the passage here in full. In 1786, in Calcutta, Jones made the following observation. "The Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could have possibly been produced by accident. So strong indeed that no philologer could examine all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which perhaps no longer exists. There is a similar reason, though not quite so forcible, for supposing that both the Gothic and the Celtic, though blended with a very different idiom, had the same origin with the Sanskrit, and the old Persian might be added to the same family, if this were the place for discussing any question concerning the antiquities of Persia." This passage, commonly referred to as the Philologer passage, because of the occurrence of this rather archaic term, can be read as prefiguring the fundamental elements of later comparative historical grammar. Jones identifies similarities in verb roots and grammatical forms across the great classical languages, Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, Gothic, Celtic, and Persian, and he attributes these similarities to common ancestry, where the common ancestor has been lost to time. The passage appeared in Jones's third anniversary discourse to the Royal Asiatic Society in Calcutta, a scholarly club for learned British gentlemen stationed in India. Jones had long been a student of Oriental languages, his nickname was in fact Oriental Jones, and his primary motivation in going to India was to master Sanskrit. In Calcutta, he was central to European scholarship on India and the East, and instrumental in the founding of the Asiatic Society. Jones is in many ways the archetypal representative of the 18th century scholar-cum-colonial administrator, the kind of figure that serves as grist to the mill of the young field of post-colonial studies. As Edward Said pointed out in his 1978 Orientalism, the book that more or less launched post-colonial studies, Jones was undeniably a member of the colonial caste, appropriating the cultural knowledge of India and repackaging it for a European audience. Jones's scholarly engagement with India was made possible by the political and military power of the British East India Company on the subcontinent at the time. Indeed, Jones's day job was judge at the British Supreme Court of Calcutta, where he quite literally sat in judgment of the company's Bengali subjects. Jones's image of European and Indian kinship is most certainly a colonial projection. However, as historian Thomas Troutman argues in his 1997 book, Aryans and British India, Jones's scholarly generation emphasized the commonalities between East and West. At least in the domain of Sanskrit studies, orientalizing scholarship that highlighted what from a European perspective might seem exotic and strange, and used this as a justification and instrument of colonial control, was something that became much more prevalent in subsequent generations. At this point, we may pause for a moment to ask why Jones's preferred mode of explanation for the similarities he noticed was common descent. This mode of explanation is so deeply ingrained in our ideas of how the history of languages should be conceived that we might even take it for granted. The answer is that the point of departure for Jones, and for many of his contemporaries, was the account of human origins and history contained in the Bible. Jones assumed a mosaic ethnology. That is, Jones's picture of the origin and descent of humanity was shaped by the account sketched in Genesis, the Book of Moses. The observed similarities between languages are evidence of the spreading of Noah's descendants across the world after the Great Flood. According to Jones, each of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, begat distinct lineages that populated different regions of the world. Japheth's descendants moved to the north of Asia and Europe and became the nomadic herders to be encountered there today. Shem's people settled in the Near East, and Ham's children established themselves in Africa and India, and then later moved on to Greece, Italy, and the rest of Europe. Suddenly, Jones's flash of insight igniting a new scientific linguistics looks like a medieval hangover. Within a generation of Jones, no one would seriously adopt such a literal interpretation of biblical genealogy. But the principles underlying his approach still colour comparative historical grammar up to the present day. We still speak of language families and draw family trees. While we might not identify the nodes in our trees with the sons of Noah, they preserve the principle of patrilineal descent. The trees branch out as a parent language begets its child languages. In this model, any other kind of language relationship is considered an aberration. As we'll see in following episodes, this has been a point on which comparative historical grammar has been repeatedly challenged throughout its history. Although the standard narrative of comparative historical grammar starts with a quotable quote from a Briton in Calcutta, its focus quickly shifts to the country in which this new paradigm found an institutional home, Germany. In the new research universities founded in the German states around the beginning of the 19th century, there grew up a cadre of professors and their students whose chief occupation it was to develop and refine methods of comparison and to fill in the details of the emerging genealogical picture. The text credited with introducing Sanskrit studies to an eager audience in Germany is the 1808 bestseller Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Indier, on the language and wisdom of the Indians, by Friedrich Schlegel. This book is perhaps also the first text to establish the tradition of citing the Philologer passage. Friedrich Schlegel is best known as one of the chief initiators of Romanticism, a cultural movement emphasizing nature, emotions, and individual creativity as a reaction against the cool and condescending rationalism of the Enlightenment. Romanticism swept through the artistic and intellectual world of Europe around the turn of the 18th to the 19th century and gained significant traction in the German-speaking lands. Schlegel's Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Indier is a book born of romantic sentiment. It offers the educated European reader an exploration infused with mysticism of ancient Indian language, philosophy, history, and literature. Schlegel's book opens with the observation that Sanskrit has the greatest affinity with the Greek and Latin, as well as the Persian and German languages. The affinity that Schlegel postulated is, however, not precisely the same as that earlier put forward by Jones. Schlegel saw Sanskrit as the most ancient of the languages he named, from which the others were derived, whereas Jones, of course, imagined an ancestor common to all of them, lost to time. But Schlegel looked to the same kind of linguistic evidence in constructing his genealogical relationships, namely the thoroughgoing similarities in words and grammatical forms across languages. The first part of Schlegel's book is largely dedicated to the detailed exemplification of these similarities. Most important for demonstrating genealogical relationships, according to Schlegel, are the correspondences in the inner grammatical structure of languages, to be determined by comparative grammar. He comments, "But the decisive point that will illuminate everything is the inner structure of the languages, or comparative grammar, which will inform us about the genealogy of languages in a similar way to which comparative anatomy has cast light on the higher levels of natural history." Here we see the sense in which the comparative in comparative historical grammar is meant. The analogy is with comparative anatomy, a science that had made great advances in these years and had accrued significant prestige. Through the work of such scholars as Johannes Friedrich Blumenbach in Göttingen and Georges Cuvier in Paris, the fledgling field of comparative anatomy began painting a vivid picture of the antediluvian world. Working with nothing but fragments of fossilized skeletons and the similarities of these to those of living creatures, the comparative anatomists were able to reconstruct prehistoric animals and put forward hypotheses about their lifestyle and habits. Inspiration was not unidirectional, but reciprocal. Just as the grammarians sought to model themselves on the anatomists, the anatomists looked to the example of antiquarians. The antiquarians of the outgoing 18th century, in their efforts to understand and reconstruct the ancient world, moved beyond the traditional literary sources to examine archaeological remains, inscriptions, coins, ruins, and the remnants of daily life. Both Blumenbach and Cuvier commented that, following the same principles as the antiquarians, their own work aimed to reconstruct the past from fragments. The common practice of the antiquarians and comparative anatomists and grammarians reflects a philosophy which sees history as the stories of unique individuals, whether individual civilizations, creatures, or languages, living in contingent circumstances. The only way to understand these individuals is to examine the empirical evidence they've left behind. This approach is in contrast to the ambition of such natural sciences as physics or chemistry, which seek to discover overarching principles to explain and predict individual observed phenomena. This philosophical and methodological tension will resurface in the coming episodes. At this point, we must note that empirically oriented efforts to uncover language origins and relationships were pursued prior to Jones, Schlegel, and those who lined up as their successors. Indeed, alternative approaches to empirical language comparison continued even after academic comparative historical grammar had become established. The end of the 17th century, 100 years before Jones and Schlegel, saw increasing interest in the philosophy of language. The rampant empiricism of this era, in which experimental sciences rose to prominence, led to increasing debate about the nature of language, the medium in which we formulate our thoughts and communicate our observations. How do words have meaning, and can this meaning ever be reliable, given the inherent subjectivity of language? The English philosopher John Locke argued that the signification of words is arbitrary, and therefore there is no inbuilt guarantee of their reliability. Responding to Locke, the German philosopher and polymath Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz insisted to the contrary that there is at base a natural connection between words and their meanings, although this connection has become obscured through the historical development of languages. To find the original correspondences between words and meaning, suggested Leibniz, we should explore words' etymologies. In addition, comparing etymologies across languages would reveal the cognations and migrations of peoples across the world in cases where we have no other evidence. Although Leibniz acknowledged that etymology in his day was a largely speculative pastime, he held out the hope that it would one day become a rigorous science. To this end, he proposed collecting large samples of empirical data from the languages of the world. By Leibniz's time, there was already an established tradition of using a translation of the Lord's Prayer as a standard sample for comparison across languages. In his correspondence, Leibniz repeatedly expressed the hope that such a project could be undertaken on a large scale, in particular in the multilingual Russian Empire. This particular project in Russia was later completed in the second half of the 18th century as part of two scientific survey expeditions undertaken by the German naturalist and explorer Peter Simon Pallas, under the auspices of the Russian Empress Catherine the Great. This brand of linguistic comparativism reached its culmination in the work Mithridates, compiled by Johann Christoph Adelung, and continued after his death in three further volumes by Johann Severin Vater. This work is named after the ancient king Mithridates of Asia Minor, who was reputed to command all 22 of the languages spoken in his empire. The name Mithridates had already famously been used as the allegorical title of a 1555 book by the Swiss polymath Konrad Gessner, a book which similarly sought to survey the world's languages. The four volumes of Adelung and Vater's Mithridates contain a comprehensive selection of the world's languages and offer a translation of the Lord's Prayer with interlinear glosses for each language, accompanied by ethnographic information about the speakers and bibliographic references. The first volume of Mithridates appeared in the year of Adelung's death, 1806, and the final volume in 1817, well into the period in which the parallel tradition of comparative historical grammar had become a fully-fledged university discipline. In the next episode, we'll look at precisely how comparative historical grammar developed into a discipline, and meet two of its leading figures, Franz Popp and Jakob Grimm.